Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's our annual Oscars Omnibus Edition. As you hear this, we're a couple of days away from the ceremony, and there are 8 Best Picture nominees and a fair amount of other business to discuss. We'll talk about some favorites and, of course, some oversights. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
You can help improve NPR's podcasts by sharing your opinions in a brief survey. Please log on to npr.org/PCHHsurvey. We would love to hear from you.
It's Academy Awards week here at Pop Culture Happy Hour, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And every year at this time, we love to share the studio with Bob Mondello, who comes in for the Oscars show. Bob, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies for All Things Considered.
So the way we're going to do the Oscars Omnibus today, we're going to start by talking about these 8 Best Picture nominees, and then we'll get to a bunch of other stuff. Some of these we have existing shows on, and we're going to go a little bit short on those. We had a show about The Martian, which you can find in our archives. We liked The Martian, yeah?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Sure.
We dug The Martian.
Absolutely.
A lot.
Yeah, that was also based on a book I liked a lot.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that movie is that movie too entertaining to be a real Oscar contender, though?
Yeah, I also...
Is it punishing enough?
I also think maybe it came out a little early.
Yeah.
It didn't come out right at the end
of
the year.
Like in October.
Yeah, it didn't come out right at the end of the year, but I like it. We liked that movie.
There's a couple other movies up for nomination which have the same measure of sort of geniality, I would argue. So might not
Oh, no, absolutely. I just... That movie has only grown in my estimation. I found it charming and gripping and like the sort of big, fun, like, mixture of I guess you would say, science fiction and comedy that you don't always necessarily see as an Oscar, not that it's a front runner, but as an Oscar bait kind of movie.
Yeah, every year, you always have to have, as a movie critic, you have to have something that you can send people to at the end of the year. And the one I was sending people to just sort of automatically this year was The Martian. And it was the one that everybody always came back and said, oh, that was great. They argued with me about all the other ones.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this may be the least divisive movie.
Yeah. Another one that we did a show about was Bridge of Spies.
Right.
Which has Tom Hanks, and I felt was fine.
Sure.
I don't know if I thought it was anything I would nominate for Best Picture.
Would a yawn translate on the air?
Well, and they nominated that Mark Rylance performance.
Yeah,
which was the best thing in that movie.
It had a great scene. It had that one wonderful scene where they were building the Berlin Wall, and you could still step across it because it was only like one cinder block high, and you watched people not doing that and realize that this was going to mean that their lives were sort of restricted for a generation, which was just weird, very tense and wonderful, and the only thing in that picture that got me.
Yeah.
If this picture were not by Steven Spielberg, it would not have made the cut this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's an okay picture. Everybody respects it. It's decently made. But I don't know what other claims you could make for it.
Yeah. Another one that we did not devote an entire show to, but that's come up a number of times, is The Big Short, which, Stephen, I would ask you to speak to this one because you really like this movie and I think perhaps are its best advocate.
It's so funny. For a movie that's going for such a kind of affable tone, I found the degree of difficulty in this movie really striking. Mm-hmm. That they took a very complex story about the financial crisis brought about by the collapse of mortgage. I mean, just throwing the terms out bores me. and took this movie and injected all of this fizzy energy into it. And I know that Linda was bothered by some of the kind of broiness of the film, and I think that's a completely fair and legitimate knock on it. But at the same time, I just liked the way this movie always seemed to be in motion. It was really whirring along in a way that I found kind of exciting, even though it is a movie about kind of rotten people exploiting rotten loopholes in the economy.
Well, and you guys saw it after people had started talking about it, right? Because I saw it back at the beginning before, mm-hmm. and the only thing I knew about it was that this was from the guy who made Anchorman.
Right.
Yeah.
And excuse me, this is not like Anchorman.
Right,
and
it was, right.
Well, and like, I, it was and, like and like Talladega Nights.
Right.
I mean, this is Adam McKay is a comedy director
right.
taking on an Oscar kind of movie.
Yeah, and that led to some of the unevenness that, I mean, I like this film, didn't love it. I'm going to be saying that a lot over the course of this thing. But it was like he was trying to eat his cake and have it too. So you've got these Anthony Bourdain, Selena Gomez, Margot Robbie as addressing the camera, sort of doing direct address, and that didn't scan with the rest of the film.
I was able to put together my feelings about this movie a little better after I listened to an episode of the Nerdist Writers panel mm-hmm. with Charles Randolph, who is the co-writer of this movie, wrote it and worked on it with Adam McKay, mm-hmm. who I think reworked the script a little bit in the course of directing it. And one of the things that Randolph said is that the way he thinks that those asides work in the movie is that nobody in the movie is relatable. Nobody in the movie is terribly likable. So he said, when you get those asides, the filmmaker enters the movie and presents these things to you as these kind of little extra things. So he said, the filmmaker is doing these kind of fun, likable little bits where that's how the filmmaker becomes kind of the person that you're plugged into in the movie that you sympathize with. And I realized as soon as I saw Margot Robbie in the bathtub, kind of like, now here's a blonde in a bathtub to explain the movie, as I said, to quote unquote you, I immediately was put off by it
right.
because I immediately felt like, oh, this person assumes that he's talking to a bunch of straight dudes. And so to me, the exact thing that the screenwriter thinks is your way into the movie was very alienating to me. So I can understand how, even if everything else everybody is saying about the movie is absolutely true, I could understand how, if that didn't work, then that didn't work.
Yeah.
So another one that we had some coverage of and some discussion of was Mad Max. Glenn is making a very, very happy face about Mad Max Fury Road. We had a small batch with Glenn and our buddy Chris Klimek. Glenn, talk a little bit about Mad Max Fury Road.
This, to me, was, of the entire year, the purest, best, perfect movie-going experience. I like Star Wars a lot. This felt to me, like, I'm not a fan of the original Mad Max series. I saw all those films as an adult. And when you see those films as an adult, they're just cheesy. And they are the worldview of a 14-year-old boy, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it does feel kind of like a revenge film dressed up in, like, leather weekend gear. You know, it doesn't scan. It doesn't hold together. This film, if we can talk about growth of a filmmaker, this felt like a filmmaker revisiting a place he's been to many times as an adult. Mm-hmm. We get to hear from women in a way we haven't before, in a meaningful way in this series, and we get them to present themselves to us and become individuals, and they're driving the plot. They're not ground up in its gears, and it's funny, and it's gorgeous to look at, and the stunts are breathtaking. Just everything about this is a pure filmmaking experience was a delight. I was very happy to see this on the list.
Yeah. Where were you on this movie, Bob?
He gets no argument from me at all. I love this movie. It was just amazing. It was like a demolition derby with content.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful time at it. I thought it was sensationally directed and just beautiful to watch. And George Miller is a guy who's done a lot of other things in his career, right? He did Babe, Pig in the City. He did. I mean, you know, there are things that he's done since those original Mad Max movies that are really kind of in a different direction. So seeing him come back to this and do it as if it had never been done, and it was just, you know, wow, it was great.
Part of what I really, really enjoyed about this movie, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought there were elements of it were a little silly, but I enjoyed the fact that here is this very serious, very portentous life and death struggle that has all these elements of kind of goofiness to it. Mm-hmm. The dude with the guitar that shoots flame. Like, there are moments in that movie where you are pumping your fist like, woo, at a movie that is nominated for Best Picture. And like you said, I'm just really, really glad this movie is nominated. Mm-hmm. If you look at like a sentimental favorite, like one thing that I would really love to see George Miller win Best Director.
Yeah.
That would be great.
I think, Stephen, what you're interpreting as goofiness, I interpreted as very, very stylish work that he's doing in this movie with the guy with the guitar. And I feel like it's almost, because there's not too much of that, it didn't tip over into silliness
into
for
camper,
me. It stayed It didn't tip over into camp. It stayed right in that place where you kind of just feel like it's very audacious. And that's how I felt about it. And there's a scene that I put on my list of 50 wonderful things from 2015 in which the guys on the trucks are on these poles that bend back and forth. And what I love about it is it would be so easy for everything amazing and cool about that to all about these car chases to be all effects and to be all bombast and to get these gently bending poles, which are actually incredibly graceful to watch.
Instead of, say, fast and
or
furious.
I thought was such a wonderful detail. I am not the natural audience for this movie necessarily, and I enjoyed it enormously. It's so beautiful to look at. I think when you look at this movie, I just felt like I was watching it thinking, like, that's an amazing shot, and that's an amazing shot. And, I mean, it is pure pleasure to me as a cinematic experience. Uh-huh. Yeah, I liked this one a whole lot, too. Another great pleasurable one to me was Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And, Stephen, you and I think, both have talked in our What's Making Us Happy about Brooklyn. So, Bob, how do you feel about Brooklyn?
I thought it was very nice. That's about as far as I would go with it. I thought it was a beautiful costume epic. I, as a child of, well, a grandchild of immigrants, was looking at it and feeling as if that could be my grandparents. It was it was instructive to me about the immigrant experience and all of that. And that said, it felt tame and pretty and like
God forbid it'd like be beautiful to look at.
Well, I know, but it's
no, I know what you mean.
I wanted some edge to it, and it just didn't have it.
You know, it's a
more bar fights.
Yeah, exactly.
That would
more suffering, more seeping wounds,
more bare knuckled.
One bear mauling. The killing, one mauling. you know, it's a luminous film. It glows with warmth, and at the end of the day, you step out of that theater feeling very sort of comforted in a weird way. This warmth really envelops you. What I liked about it is that you think it's going to be about this woman, and it turns out to be about these women, this culture of women that surround her and support her. And one by one, every member of the supporting cast gets to step out and sort of individualize herself and become a real character. The two exceptions to that are the two dudes who are just very pretty ciphers, one-dimensional, idealized beings who exist entirely defined by their relationship with her. And if you think about that for more than 2 seconds, you're like,
you're right.
Fair.
Yeah.
Okay, fair. Yeah. After 100 years
of
Hollywood,
I can live with it.
Turnabout is fair play. Go with it. You go.
Yeah, sorry. I wasn't trying to cut you off. I think the one thing I would take issue with is that I think what makes the movie so good to me and the reason I like it is I actually think those guys are not perfect, particularly the guys she knows in Brooklyn.
Right.
I think as a woman, when I was watching that movie, there are things about that guy that make you say, that's not how you want that guy to act.
I wasn't sure I was supposed to be rooting for that relationship.
I'm not sure. I wasn't sure I was rooting for that relationship.
Hey, he's Italian.
There are a few. That's not the problem. That's not what I meant. I think there are a few things about him where you think, I'm not sure if he's a good boyfriend.
Right.
And to me, the entire point of this movie, and I think I can say without spoiling it, the entire point of this movie is really not she knows two guys and she has to decide which guy she's going to wind up with. It is coming to terms with the fact that what adulthood means and what maturity means is the very act of making some choice. And you always lose something. And your life, it's always true, your life can go along several different paths and you're only going to ever get to see how one of them turns out. Mm-hmm. And you just have to give up on the other possibilities in your life and understand that there's grief in that of a type.
That's lovely.
I was
That's
so,
nice.
So charmed by this movie. I also could listen to Linda talk about it all day.
I was just thinking that.
I have really, really strong feelings about the story of this movie and why I think it is a romance of a kind that I think they don't make enough of.
Yeah.
And perhaps I will wax more rhapsodic with this movie in some other context at some other time. But also, as I think I mentioned when I talked about it in the What's Making Me Happy this week, go back and watch this movie and just watch what she's wearing in different scenes. Because for one thing, she talks about the fact that she doesn't have a lot of clothes. And then they make good on that by the fact that you see her wearing the same things over and over and over again. Watch when she's wearing the green coat versus the red coat and when she switches from the green coat to the red coat. And watch when the green coat matches the background versus when the red coat matches the background. That's all I'm going to say about that. So another one that Bob and I saw in Toronto was Room, which is based on the Emma Donoghue novel, and she adapted it. Well, how did you like Room, Bob?
I liked Room a lot. It, you know, when you go into something, then you really don't know what it's going to be. And I had not read the novel, and I just sort of had no point of reference for this at all, except that someone had said it's about a woman who's locked in a room with her small child, and they have to get out. And on that basis, I'm watching this picture, and at about the 55-minute mark, they've finished the part that I thought they were going for.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, it became a very interesting character study and a psychological study after that, in ways that I wasn't expecting from this picture.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a very engrossing and interesting picture. I was then very startled when it won the award at Toronto, because I was convinced that Martian was going to walk away with that. And I was even more startled when it became a sort of a picture to beat in the Oscar sweepstakes, partly because the audience never embraced this picture. The audience never went to it. It's made a few million dollars.
Yeah.
I find its story compelling.
Yeah. Hmm. How about you, Glenn? Where are you on this movie?
Well, I had read the novels, so I was waiting for everything to kind of... I was checking off boxes in my head, which is not a great way to see a film. But it's unfair to compare it to the book, but the book was better. and this movie improved upon the book in one particular way, which is, I'm not going to spoil anything, but somewhere in this film, there's a scene with a rug and a truck. And that scene is so suspenseful.
It's
and
really so well done in the movie.
So well done and
yeah,
so
it's
purely
wonderful
enjoyable
scene.
That it made the price of admission worth it, whatever. But again, a lot of the stuff that worked really well in the book kind of falls flat here. The voice of the kid, I don't think, is really working very well.
I think the voiceover, the brief voiceover bits are probably a mistake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, you know, it ticks the boxes and it succeeds in one very specific way. But otherwise, yeah, sure. Liked, didn't love.
Loved, didn't like.
Yeah.
No, I actually did like. I liked and loved it. I was really moved by this movie. I loved the way it's structured. I was watching it with someone who had read the book, so I was getting some of the running tally of what it did and didn't do. But I love the way that the story, there's a major event right in the middle of this movie, and I love the way this movie puts equal weight on each half of that story. And both of them are incredibly powerful. I loved this movie. And Brie Larson, who I think we all agree is very likely to win Best Actress, I think she's magnificent in this movie.
Yep. Very, very fine young actress if you haven't seen her in Short Term 12 or as the sister in Trainwreck.
That's
which
right.
She also was this year or, you know, any of her other great work. I'm a big fan of her. So another one that Stephen has mentioned in his Happy, as well as our friend Audie Cornish did and our friend Gene Demby did, is Spotlight, which is about the Boston Globe's investigation of Catholic priests in Boston. How about Bob? How about Spotlight?
Yeah, it was fine.
Oh, my God, man.
No. I don't get me wrong. I think it's a very well-done...
Bob's given out a lot of B-pluses.
Sorry, that's what I've been saying all year. It's fine as a sort of journalistic procedural in which almost every event has to happen at the last second so someone can run somewhere, right? So that Mark Ruffalo has to run to the courthouse to get some kind of documents, and he has to run back because there's a deadline. And they keep trying to pump into it all kinds of energy, which if you are a journalist, you know that there is a certain amount of energy that goes into the creating of a story like that. But it isn't that kind of energy. And what they were trying to turn it into, I think, was All the President's Men. And they succeeded to a certain extent in doing that. I mean, look, the subject matter is so important and is so well timed to what has happened in the world in the last couple of years that it's hard to just dismiss it. And I'm not dismissing it. I just thought it was fine. You know, a really nicely made, solid picture.
Oh, I loved this movie, man. I would love to see this win Best Picture. And it seemed for a while like it was going to, and now everybody's talking about The Revenant, which we'll get to. I mean, I talked about this in the Happy segment, but I just love the subtlety of the characterization in this movie. I love the way that it takes all these journalists, and instead of having them give big, huffing, puffing Oscar clip speeches at each other, it weighs its story so much more heavily than it weighs the story of these people. Mm-hmm. The star of this movie is the story that's being told, and these reporters are the vessels through which it's told. The way that characters are brought in, like the new guy who's running the paper, and you think he's going to be one thing, and he just turns out to be another thing. It kind of undercuts a lot of these cliches. I didn't find that it was pumping a lot of artificial weight. I thought it was always pulling back when I expected it to, you know, throttle forward. So I loved it and still was propelled by the energy of it. This was probably my favorite movie of the year.
Where are you with Spotlight Line?
I liked it for a lot of the same reasons that Stephen mentioned. The avoidance of grandstanding, the avoidance of that kind of self-righteous, self-aggrandizing aspect that you're expecting in a film like this. The fact that this is a portrait of devastation as mediated by the media, by the journalistic process.
Yeah.
So you see the ramifications. It's smart enough to allow these victims to come forward and be very different from one another.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's not, we're not putting them all in a box. We're not
saying
this is what happens. I think it's very important that we see, and I tried to look up the actor's name, but the actor who plays the gay victim, the adult, he conveys how complicated his life has become on that. And that really, really conveys. It allows these people to kind of stand. Now, there is a layer of aggrandizing. Mark Ruffalo kind of juts up right against it. He gets one scene where and there's some ticks. You'll forgive me. There's a couple ticks in the performance, but ultimately it just builds up to something really solid.
Yeah, I really like how straightforwardly shot and made that film is. I think, although there's also a wonderful video essay that I'll link to from the blog post about the way that they shoot it so that the church is very often in the background of shots where they're outdoors so that you're reminded of that. Because I think maybe more than anything since The Wire, it's really an effort to take a story that is about people, but really make it a story about institutions, not just the institution of the Catholic Church, but also the institution of the Boston Globe and the way that those two very, very large and powerful institutions in Boston interact with each other. It was very interesting to see a very early mention of the idea that if you are a new editor at the Boston Globe, the church will invite you to essentially have a sit down. And it was like, oh, really? And that was that stuff was fascinating to me. So I like this movie a lot. The last of the Best Picture nominees is the one that we have not really spent time with on the show before, which is The Revenant. This is so, as Glenn would say, this is so not for Linda's that I feel like I'm not a good source on this movie, because even if it was very good at being the thing that it is, which is essentially a theater of pain and agony, I probably wouldn't like it. So I'm going to turn it over to, I don't know, who likes a theater of agony? Do you like a theater of agony?
I would not have characterized myself in quite that way. On the other hand, I do think the movie is very effective. When I first saw this picture, everybody had been talking about the bear attack, and it was all anybody talked about ahead of time. And we were in a theater, and the opening scene of this movie, which is 23 minutes before the bear attack, in any other movie would be what everybody was talking about. It's a scene where some trappers are loading pelts onto a barge, and all of a sudden they are beset upon by a Native American tribe that is very upset with them for a variety of different reasons. And it is a spectacular scene. And this is by the guy, Alejandro González Iñárritu, who just directed Birdman last year. And that picture was all about long single shots, right?
Yeah.
And this opening bit is almost shot in one take. Mm-hmm. And it is so complicated. People falling out of trees, people being shot with arrows. It was just an astonishing bit of filmmaking. There's a lot of gorgeous filmmaking in it. I mean, if you saw this picture and Hateful Eight the same day, which is what happened to me.
Oh, man.
Which is what happened to me. You're looking at two pictures that are set in the Wild West, one of which is in 70 millimeter, and it's not this one, right? And this one looked so spectacular and was such beautiful filmmaking. And yes, it's incredibly brutal. And it's really hard to not say that about the picture. And yet, for what it is, which is essentially the perils of Leo, I guess.
Yeah.
It is a very effectively made movie. I think the last little bit of it, when it becomes just a revenge thing, is less interesting than when it's a survivalist epic. Mm-hmm. But wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Glenn?
I liked it a lot. I mean, one point you do have to step back and ask yourself, okay, so is this acting as Iron Man competition? Is this acting as torture porn?
Yeah.
Is that what we're rating this guy for? Because I do think that Tom Hardy does a lot more with his part than Leo DiCaprio does with his in terms of getting us a picture of that guy. The guy that Tom Hardy is playing is very specific, very particular. He's a jerk, but you know exactly what kind of jerk he is. And this guy, Leo DiCaprio, is surviving, and he cares about his kid.
Well, in fairness, Mr. Hardy has lines.
Yeah, it's true.
And Leo DiCaprio has grunts.
Lots of grunts.
Yeah. A lot of grunting.
I think it's a really good point, though, that I wanted to bring up about the Oscars in general and this idea of degree of difficulty. Mm-hmm. And why when we talk about degree of difficulty, we're so often, sometimes we're talking about accents, and sometimes we're talking about physical transformation, where somebody loses a lot of weight or gains a lot of weight. And in this movie, the degree of difficulty that everyone has assigned to this Leonardo DiCaprio part is, oh my God, he went out and went through this incredible process of being in this movie. And like you said, he ate the bison liver and blah, blah, blah. He's in the cold. He's grunting miserably throughout the movie. Is that the only way for a part to be hard? Like, when we talk about degree of difficulty, like, isn't making a movie about being stranded on Mars funny also really difficult? Like, isn't making a Star Wars movie that most people like and enough to make billions of dollars, isn't that like maybe the hardest thing that was done in the movies last year?
Well,
we only talk about this one kind of physicality as a marker of degree of difficulty.
In fairness to Mr. DiCaprio, he has tried all the other ways to get
nominated. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Tom Hardy, because when Stephen mentions degree of difficulty, the movie I think of is a movie called Lock, in which Tom Hardy is in a car, driving in a car for the entire movie. Yeah. He's the only person in it. He's on his Bluetooth, essentially. That's the entire movie. That, to me, is harder than this. That, to me, is harder to make good than anything that's in
and
this
movie.
And
even this year, he was in Legend, and he played two characters who were very different and who had a knockdown, drag-out. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't with a bear, but they had a fight. He's a remarkable actor, and I give you all of that.
All right. Well, we have run down our Best Picture nominees. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to run down a whole bunch of questions. We're going to talk about some people that weren't nominated. We're going to talk about some of our favorite performances, and we are going to get into this issue of the extremely white acting nominees and perhaps talk about some things that we would have loved to see nominated and maybe hopes for the future in that arena. So come right back.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Weebly. You don't have to be a web designer or know code to create a fantastic website with Weebly. Created for people with the courage to start their own business and the dream to be their own boss. Choose from professionally designed mobile-friendly themes. Then just drag and drop to quickly build and publish your site and update your site on any device. Get started for free at weebly.com/happyhour. weebly.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We are right in the middle of our Oscars omnibus. Now, we have gone through our Best Picture nominees, and now we want to talk about a bunch of other stuff. One thing that I wanted to quickly run down was some performances that are nominated that we can talk about, one of which is Cate Blanchett in Carol. Not nominated for Best Picture, but she's nominated. Are you a fan of that performance, Bob?
I thought she was lovely in it. She was essentially playing my mother, I think.
Really?
Well, no, not entirely. Okay, I'm overstating. Her hats and her gloves.
Yeah, I gotcha. I understand.
Costuming-wise.
You liked Carol.
I really, really liked Carol, and I thought Cate Blanchett is wonderful in it. Cate Blanchett is pretty typically wonderful. Mm-hmm. For me, in that movie, the performance that really stood out was Rooney Mara. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, she is nominated in the supporting category. You do start to get into some weird Oscars rules.
Category,
it doesn't make any sense.
Like Rooney Mara is in that movie more than Cate Blanchett, and yet it's technically supposed to be a supporting role. But I thought she was a revelation. I know I liked this movie better than Glenn did.
I liked, didn't love Carol. It is intentionally and artfully bloodless. We see all these characters through glass repeatedly, over and over again. It is very stylized, and what Cate Blanchett is doing is affected in the way that that character would be affected. It made a lot of sense to me. In a similarly, Trumbo, not to pivot away from it real quick,
sure,
but Bryan Cranston is nominated for Trumbo, and that, he's obviously studied the tapes. He's watched the newsreels. He's seen how this guy talks. And he is doing that to a T while everybody around him in the movie is not necessarily doing that. I mean, when you have a scene where with him and Louis C.K., who I think is very good in Trumbo, basically being like Louis C.K. just stepped out of the credit sequence of his show, just dropped a pizza and then walked on another thing. There's a disconnect there. And that's either the fact that this Trumbo guy was actually so affected and talked like this.
Right.
Or that the director didn't come along and say, can we all be in the same movie? Can we all try to be in the same movie?
Yeah. And so when we were talking about Cate Blanchett, I was thinking about the fact that that performance, which is kind of a cool woman, is up against this Charlotte Rampling performance in 45 Years, which is also this kind of, through much of the movie, very reserved woman. Where are you on 45 Years, Glenn?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I didn't love it while I was watching it. This is a film that has a very slow burn that you don't really know what it's about. It's building to something. And these performances are so... It's less stylized. It's quieter. It felt to me truer than Carol. Maybe because I'm just more interested in things, the way that things shatter versus how they come together. Maybe I think that it's just more, people come together in only a certain handful of ways, and there's millions of different ways people can come apart. And I think coming apart can be more interesting if it's as specific and as slow burn as this particular film is. Everything is, while I was watching it, I did want a bear attack because I'd seen it right after Revenant. It's like, and I can tell you the moment it should happen, it's like they're setting up for a big event and somebody says, should we have the tea sandwiches or possibly, cucumber? That's when it should come. But this again, it doesn't work while you're watching it, but there's something about the way it builds to the end. And I don't want to blow it out, right, Bob? You don't want to make it too big. Yeah. What happens is very small and contained, but it just colors your entire impression of what's come before.
Yeah, it comes down to a single gesture, and it's,
God.
And it is so specific and so, and I think that is much harder to do, to put this implacable sense of doom and build it into every frame in a way that doesn't call out and make it seem like it's doing that. I just love 45 Years.
In the realm of, we're kind of going through several kind of emotionally reserved pretty movies. I have some intel in the past from Bob talking about The Danish Girl, and kind of, which is not nominated for Best Picture, but there are some other nominations for that one as well. Can you talk a little bit about The Danish Girl, Bob?
It's okay. I think that the picture that they started out to make was a very careful movie about a transgender character. And by the time the picture came out, you didn't have to be careful about the transgender character anymore. Mm-hmm. And so after Caitlyn Jenner and the world. This feels like a picture for your great Aunt Tilly about this kind of character, when in fact we could have done something much more bold and brave and all kinds of things with it.
Yeah. This to me really seems like when people talk about Oscar movies and the genre of Oscar movies, this is The Imitation Game. This is in the genre of Oscar movies.
There is a term of art that we big-time critics use. We employ it judiciously because...
wait to hear.
Because people who aren't as versed in film theory may not be familiar with it, so we tend to have to explain it. But this film is thirsty. This is the thirstiest film I have ever seen. This wants Oscars so bad. And as you say, it's so careful and circumspect and reverent and important. And the thing with the scarf just had me giggling. It's exactly right. It's well made and the acting is great, but woof.
Yeah, it's really funny. I have not seen The Danish Girl, but based on what I have heard, I sort of feel like the most interesting and daring thing that Eddie Redmayne has done recently was Jupiter.
Jupiter.
I agree.
Totally.
I agree.
So I want a little more of that Eddie Redmayne, if in fact it is the case that people are not getting as much daring as they would like from this. So I want to pivot a little bit and talk about things not nominated. And one of the reasons for that is that every acting nominee this year is a white person. Mm-hmm. And overwhelmingly, the movies are about white people and made by white people for the most part. So not exclusively to that issue, but I do want to make sure that we get outside of nominees for that reason. And I want to talk about a movie that I saw just recently, which has popped up on a bunch of these lists, which is Tangerine. Tangerine is about two prostitutes in L.A. who are just kind of spending a day largely at donut time. One of them is determined to kind of go after her boyfriend, who she is hearing, who I think is also her pimp, who she is hearing has been cheating on her. And there is an entire, describing the plot of this movie is very difficult. There's a cab driver who's involved. And when people talk about, you know, movie shot, you can shoot a movie on an iPhone now. Mm-hmm. My understanding is actually shot this movie on an iPhone.
Yep.
It is so unexpected, and its framing and structure is so natural, and it just feels like you are walking right into this story and you are walking right into the lives of these women. And the interesting thing is the fact that they are transgender is part of the story, but it is not the thing that makes them interesting. They have fully realized personalities and tenderness toward other people and arguments with other people. But that's a very, you know, that's not incidental to the story, but it's also not the whole story.
I am so glad that you liked this picture as much as I did. I was so blown away by it. And I think, you know, partly because, of course, it's filmed on an iPhone 5 and you just think, oh, my goodness, this is amazing that you can get all that. And it's so alive. And they were actually talking about the possibility that this was going to be a vehicle for a transgender acting nomination
for Maya Taylor,
yes, who is extraordinary in the film, and I think that would have been really interesting. She was maybe going to be a best supporting actress as opposed to Eddie Redmayne's best actor. And that was a really interesting. I mean, I think if that had happened, this Oscars ceremony would be infinitely more interesting to watch.
It is a really intensely terrific movie.
Yeah.
Ditto, I would say, Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, who plays the lead, who is also really wonderful. And this is also great because this is a movie that is streaming on Netflix already. So if you're interested in Tangerine, you can go seek it out on Netflix. Speaking of Netflix, I also want to quickly touch on Beasts of No Nation, which stars really a bunch of kids, but also in a supporting role has Idris Elba, who I think some people thought perhaps would be nominated for this.
The conventional wisdom on this is that Sly Stallone is going to be the winner for supporting actor for this because you know, it's his property. Rocky and all that. And also because it's not fair to say he's never done a performance that's really striking, but he hasn't done something this, you know, self-effacing and gentle and all of that.
But there's no reason in the world why Creed isn't in this list more often. I mean, it was a hit. It is a crowd-pleasing film. It's really well done and fun and engaging, and Michael B. Jordan is fantastic.
Michael B. Jordan, I think should be there.
Doesn't make any sense.
I definitely wanted to talk about this movie, too. And I wanted to talk about Ryan Coogler, the director, who is an incredibly interesting and exciting young talent. Fruitvale Station is terrific. And certainly, like, again, you know, I go back again and again to Degree of Difficulty. He took this incredibly stale, tired franchise and did something that was touching, but also crowd-pleasing and exciting, and resuscitated a property that was just moldering.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if you haven't listened to the episode that we did with our pal Gene Demby about Creed, I would encourage you to go back and listen to it, because I think Gene did a really good job of articulating what is so intense about the story of Michael B. Jordan in this movie, and what is so cool about that performance, and what is so, like, energizing about it. And that's when we talk about these movies that are kind of nice and polite, what I like about the inclusion at least of Mad Max and to some degree The Martian is movies that are a little bit more muscular but not exclusively through suffering. And my thing about Beasts of No Nation, which I think is a good movie, I don't know if I thought it was a great movie. I think the performances in it are very good. I'm not sure the dramatic structure is quite as strong as I wish it were. But like The Revenant, Beasts of No Nation is basically a movie that is a wail of pain. And it is hard for me to understand if, in fact, the performances in The Revenant and the movie The Revenant are so deserving of so many awards. It is difficult for me to justify why a movie like Beasts of No Nation, which is also an incredibly evocative and powerful, if nothing else, distillation of pain and anguish, it's a film about child soldiers, why that would not be equally deserving.
Do you think it has anything to do with the politics of Netflix? Do you think it's the Academy railing against the...
I don't know.
It's not inconceivable, but I think as a practical matter, these awards were designed back in 1927 or whenever they started them, they were designed to reward the major film studios. And the fact that everybody else, that they allow other people to sneak in there every once in a while is they consider largesse. I mean, if you're looking at what ought to have been nominated for Best Picture this year, you'd be hard-pressed to leave out Son of Saul, for instance. Right. But that's something that, that gets into another category.
That is Holocaust drama that Bob has spoken about
and is incredibly powerful. And you'd also be hard-pressed to leave out Inside Out. Which is, however, there's a category for that, right?
Right.
You can put that into the animation category. So talking about what ought to have been nominated is like an exercise in I don't know what.
It is a very complicated question. Yeah.
And here's one way you fix it so easily. And they've talked about doing this in terms of trying to bring about a more diverse slate of films. Is this whole business, there used to be 5 Best Picture nominees. And now there's this whole weird system where it's between 5 and
they
10.
They went to 10 and then they pulled it back. Between 5 and 7.
And what happens, you know, we've talked on this show before and railed against the idea of snubs. Oh, this actor was snubbed. But you can't say that somebody was snubbed without saying who they should replace. You know, there are only 5 slots. And I think when you have 8 Best Picture nominees and you could have had as many as 10, anything that didn't get nominated falls into that category of, well, they could have nominated that.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, if you look at, I think, the 3 films that came closest that probably would have taken those 2 slots that didn't get given out, you look at Inside Out, which is an animated movie. Mm-hmm. You look at Carol, which is a lesbian romance. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Straight Outta Compton. And if Straight Outta Compton had been nominated...
It has a nominated screenplay.
The screenplay is nominated, but if that movie had been nominated for Best Picture, and I'm not saying it necessarily should have, I'm definitely in the tank for Inside Out. I really love Carol. There are certainly other deserving movies. But if Straight Outta Compton had been nominated, let's say it came in 9th or 10th, there would be much less of a discussion about how white the Oscars are.
At least how purely.
How
it
purely
would, it would at least be. Yeah. It's complicated because I agree with you. You know, going to specific ones is very complicated, but at the same time, I don't know.
You could argue that Mad Max is taking the science fiction slot, right? Because if there's any film of 2015 that has stayed with me the longest, it's Ex Machina. There's no reason in the world why we're not talking about Oscar Isaac right now.
Mm-hmm.
That performance is
so
singular. You know what? The gif that should win Best Picture is that gif of him dancing in that one deeply creepy, deeply weird scene. That film has such a sense. You look at it and you think because its color palette is chilly that it's a chilly film. In fact, there is this weird, unnerving sense of dread, but it's also a sense of humor that the film has as well, that is just completely unforgettable. But you could say, okay, well, we kind of paid lip service to the Dark Knight slot, Mad Max slot. We're going to give it over.
Yeah, I want to run down just a couple of other things that I wanted to ask you guys about because I know you have some interest in some cases. Glenn, you saw the animated short World of Tomorrow.
I did. I'm in the tank for Sanjay Super Team. We talked about how much I love it.
Yep.
World of Tomorrow is really good, you guys.
Yeah, I saw
it's really, really good.
I saw it also streaming on Netflix,
it's
by the way.
Streaming on Netflix, so if you get a chance, you should definitely see it. It's much darker and much weirder. And
it's weird.
It's so weird, but it is cute. It's this dark cuteness.
It does have dark cuteness.
And it's way more cerebral, and that's not necessarily a good or bad thing, but it's just a completely different thing. And of those the two, I'm kind of torn.
Yeah.
When it comes to animated short.
And we talked a little bit among ourselves about movies that you loved that didn't get nominated. And Bob, you mentioned 99 Homes.
That movie it's a beautiful double feature with The Big Short. It is about the housing crisis and how it affects a young man who's played by Spider-Man, so that's kind of interesting.
The Andrew Garfield version of being played by Spider-Man.
Well, more or less. Uh-huh. And it's a really powerful picture, and Michael Shannon plays a predatory real estate creep. And it's just a really striking and vibrant movie. I actually feel the same way about Anomalisa. That one was like really amazing, but doesn't fit into categories neatly.
Yeah.
And so it's
fit into the animated movie.
It's going to be an interesting battle between Anomalisa, which is your Charlie Kaufman kind of very adult animated film, and Inside Out, which is such a beloved Pixar kids movie.
It's going to get blown away, right? It's got to be Inside
and
Out.
Far be it from me, man. Charlie Kaufman is behind several of my favorite movies of all time, really. And Anomalisa left me so cold.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah. I just... It's one of the rare cases where, what is the filmmaker's intent? How are we supposed to feel about that guy? Because if you're supposed to think that he is in any way profound, then I really, really have a problem
you're
with
not, movie. And I'll trade you this one for Spotlight, okay?
Yeah.
But Inside Out, I love so much.
Yeah. I also asked folks to think about baffling nominations, and Stephen and Bob mentioned the same one. So now, Bob has talked about it on All Things Considered in the past, so I'm going to go to Stephen Thompson to say what it was.
Okay, so the best song category is always a little bit of a problem in the Oscars. These are not necessarily people who are great experts on songcraft, necessarily. But Bob and I agree that the song Writings on the Wall, performed by Sam Smith for the James Bond movie Spectre. So we have a little planning document that we use when we're discussing what we're going to talk about on the show. And I actually typed up, for all of your edification, the words, "It's such a turd."
Yeah.
And I think especially Radiohead recorded a song for Spectre that didn't get used, that is so much better.
Yeah, what's frustrating about this one is that it's entirely melody challenged. As you listen to it, you can't figure out where it's going, but it's been orchestrated to sound like a Bond song.
Yeah.
And so it sounds right until you try to listen to it. And
it is dull. Yeah. I mean, I will say the Oscars ceremony that's coming up is going to be challenged by these five nominees. I listened to them back to back to back to back to back today, knowing that we might talk about Sam Smith. And I think several of them are quite effective and quite beautiful. There are several that are, I can think of at least a couple that are powerful, but they're all slow.
All right. Well, I will be curious to hear how all of you feel about the Oscars and how you feel about the nominees and how the ceremony eventually goes. Stephen and I are going to be back on the Monday after the Oscars to talk about it and how the ceremony turns out. And we're also going to be live tweeting on Sunday night, the night of the Oscars. Stephen will be, and I will be, and I think Glenn will be, and Bob will be as well.
Absolutely.
So look for us and come and tweet at us on the night of the Oscars. And when we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week. And our favorite segment, let's face it, of every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from HBO Now, the new way to stream all of HBO with no TV package required. Get all of the series, movies, docs, sports specials, and more. Download the HBO Now app on your favorite device to start your 30-day free trial instantly.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I would be remiss if I did not mention that next week we will finally see the launch of this year's Austin 100. I know I talk about this a lot. I've talked about it every year. But it is, let's face it, this is a beautiful batch of songs. I'm really, really proud of how much great music there is. It's going to launch on NPR Music, let's just say early in the week.
You put a solid couple hours of work into this.
I put a couple hours into it. Yeah. But I think what the big takeaway is, I just think there's a ton of amazing music from across a lot of different genres. If you're going to South by Southwest, if I do say so myself, I think it's an indispensable resource. But if you're not going to South by Southwest, it is just a glut of wonderful music discovery. And I really, really hope that everyone downloads it and enjoys it for in the weeks to come. The other thing I have to mention, I've been wanting to talk about this for months, but only now it can be told, that your pal and mine, Bob Boylan, just was on The Simpsons.
Yep.
and I'm so torn because I bust Bob's chops a lot. I like to pretend that I dislike Bob. I love Bob. I'm proud of Bob and all the great work he has done, but I'm so bitterly jealous. I went to his apartment.
And beat him up.
And beat him up. I went to his apartment on Sunday night for a little gathering he was having. I think I was invited mostly so he could watch me feel bad.
Yep, good. Solid.
Among other things, first of all, it was wonderful just to see. I mean, they actually animated him. They didn't include the bolo tie. That's the only mistake I think they made.
They had the hat, though.
They had the hat. Yeah. They had the glasses. It's Bob. It was really nice to watch an episode of The Simpsons in, its 28th season. I've wandered a little bit astray
as
a Simpsons fan. I don't consider it appointment viewing anymore. It was nice to have one that was appointment viewing, watch it, and I just laughed all the way through it. The Simpsons, still a funny show.
Wonderful. Look it up. Congratulations, Bob Boylan, and thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
American Crime on ABC. Not American Crime Story, but American Crime. This is not a thing that's usually in my wheelhouse. I saw clips of the first season. We're now in the second season. We're about 8 episodes into the second season. But I saw clips of the first season last year, and it just seemed very heavy and dour, and it seemed to have a coat of that sort of prestige preciousness that you detect in something like Crash. It felt like very much in a Crash zone. And I wasn't on board. And then I just kept hearing this year about the performances on the show over and over. It's kind of building up online. People kept talking about the performances, one performance in particular. So I checked it out. It's a very straight-ahead exploration of, in this season, male-on-male rape that happens at a high school party. It is not soapy. It's not stylized at all. It's not lurid. There's a tendency, in some cases, for some of the characters to kind of stand and deliver the thesis, but it is so confidently directed and incredibly well acted. I mean, Felicity Huffman plays principal of this school, and when she disavows responsibility for something, we see her washing her hands. Okay, that is not working. Everything
for
else.
Shakespeare.
Well, yeah, but see, that's the thing. Felicity Huffman, Timothy Hutton, Regina King, Lily Taylor, and here's the performance that everybody will be talking about, Connor Jessup as the kid, the victim of this assault. This show is interested not in the violence itself. It's interested in the repercussions of that violence. So when it presents violence, we either don't see it. It happens off screen, or it happens in such a kind of oblique way, mediated in a way that we don't, it doesn't really register. It's we either pull way, way, way back, or we don't really quite see it. It also is taking the time to really spend some time on what being a gay kid is like today. There's a scene, a heartbreaking scene, where he attempts everything he can do to become heterosexual, and it's unbelievably heartbreaking, and this performance is, he's not one of these characters that stands and delivers. He's not particularly eloquent, and that because this character isn't particularly eloquent, and there's so much visual, purely visual storytelling in long takes that just sits in this kind of weird objective place. It's fascinating, and these performances are unforgettable, so that's American Crime on ABC.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
If you know anything about me, after listening to me on NPR, you know I'm a Sondheim nut.
Yes.
I'm like this major Sondheim nut. And Sondheim made a show that was called Wise Guys for a while and then was called Bounce by the time it got to the Kennedy Center, and that didn't work. And it didn't work in really grand and special ways. It has a special tie to NPR because they actually recorded the cast album of Bounce at NPR in our old building.
Oh, how fascinating.
In that big studio we had. Sondheim was in the building, and we were all instructed that we were not allowed to talk to him.
Yeah.
Which was just killing me.
Yeah, I bet.
Anyway, I had all these ideas for how you could make that show better, and I almost wrote him, actually, I did write him a letter, and then I had the sense to tear it up and not send it. But it was a troubled show, and it didn't work, and it had some great stuff in it, and it just wasn't good. Mm. And he kept working on it, and he rewrote it several times, and it's now called Roadshow. And it is playing in a Chicago Shakespeare Company production at Signature Theater here in Washington for a couple more weeks. At the very beginning of this thing, the first couple of numbers started, and I thought, oh, wait, this is working this time. Oh, my God, this is working. And by the middle of it, I was thinking, how could this not be a huge hit? This is so great. And it's all this emotion that he doesn't always, I mean, you know, he's always put it in, but it isn't always extracted by the director. it's a lovely production and a lovely performance. And it just makes me feel like, yes, the world has come together again. And Sondheim is the master that I always knew he was.
How wonderful. Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. So first thing making me happy this week, when I was here last week in the studio, I was sitting here with some mittens that I made. This week I'm sitting here with a scarf that I knitted. It's very attractive, if I do say so myself.
Gorgeous.
And very simple, but it works. It will keep your neck warm. Of course, now it's 60 degrees because that's how the world works. But so that's A. And then B is a little bit of the classic galley brag, which is talking about the galley of the book that you just got. Now, the comedian / wonderful Twitter person / TV personality, Dave Holmes, is no relation to me, as I have often introduced him as Dave Holmes, no relation. His memoir is called Party of One, and it's not coming out until June. but I just got my copy today and immediately started reading it. And I told him on Twitter that I apologized for going directly to the interlude, which is called "All Right, You Jackals, Here Are Some Stories About Famous People." I have read some pieces of this book so far, and it is wonderful. And he is just one of those people who I've never met in person, but who I find delightful. And I think his story is so interesting, and he has so many interesting things to say. If you've never read his kind of pop culture writing at Vulture or Esquire, some of the other places that he writes, I encourage you to seek it out. He's one of my favorite culture writers. Yep. And I am so looking forward to reading the rest of this book now that I have read the part about you jackals. Here are some stories about famous people. So my galley of Dave Holmes' book is the other thing that is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter ordinarily and for the Oscars. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon and Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here once again for another Oscars Omnibus.
Thank you.
So great.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Car advice, tips, troubleshooting, and occasional answers to car questions. In between the laughter and the snorts, that's the Car Talk Podcast with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. Laugh along anytime to the Car Talk Podcast. Find Car Talk now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.